you're on that border, you could see all of Lebanon in front of you. At that point, if we wanted to, we could have swept through and taken all of Lebanon. From a political standpoint, I started to say, this is David, you know, Ben-Gurion did not want to go into Lebanon at all. This is as far as he wanted to go, and that was on the border, and there we were.
Ben-Gurion, B-E-N-G-U-R-I-O-N.
Right. So I had my whole company set up there along the whole border, each of the platoons, and it was a question of checking to see where they were. I went to, with Iyer Pellet. I told you I had two.
Spell that?
Yes. Iyer Pellet. Pellet is P-E-L-E-D.
Okay.
A wonderful, wonderful person. He was platoon commander. And he said, Norman, let's go forward. We had the men there. He said, let's go forward. And we went far forward from where the men are. Flopped down over there behind a rock. I took out my map. And we were able to see all of Lebanon in front of us there. And as we were looking there at the map, there was a burst of fire, and Iyer was killed. And there I was, I give a look up, and there's a whole swarm of Arabs, a couple hundred yards away, that are coming up. And when I give a look, I knew this was absolutely the end. There was absolutely no way am I getting out. And again, it's the old story, you do whatever you can when you're faced with it. So I grabbed his pistol, took my own pistol, start hollering, try to get, I didn't know if anybody could hear me, start hollering, and start firing. And the only thing that ran through my mind is the fact that my mother couldn't recognize me. Okay. Now, the reason I say that, about a week and a half before, one of our scouts had been captured by the Arabs and was completely mutilated.
Mm.
So that's all that ran through my mind was on that sort of basis. To make a long story short, all of a sudden, and I knew that this was going to be the end, all of a sudden I hear some shouts behind me and I turn around and there is my company, machine guns and all. To make a long story short, we were able to beat back the counterattack. And there we are. So what took place, naturally, I was taken down. The next day, we pulled back, and other older people from the Army came up, took our place, and we went back. It was just he was one of the most wonderful young men you can possibly imagine.
Where was he from?
He was from Haifa.
Oh.
In fact, his father was president of the Palestine Electric Company.
Mm.
And afterwards, each of those days, I'll never forget his funeral. Afterwards, when I went over to the house with Mr. and Mrs. Pellet, they had a place there right at the top of Haifa on Mount Carmel there. And they were sitting shivin. And I'll never, never forget sitting there at the table. And he was just a wonderful person. And then finally, sort of half broke down and said, why did it have to be Iyer? Why wasn't it himself?
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, Iyer was supposed to have been married that next day.
Mm.
It's one of those things.
Mm. Must have had a lasting impact upon
it. Tremendous. Well, to make a long story short.
Did you stay friendly with the family?
Yes, in fact, I'll phrase it this way. First of all, after that, I decided there was really no more war. And what I did was to resign. I spent a couple of months still there in Israel. And I was giving a lot of serious thought to the possibility of staying in Israel. And I would certainly come home, and I was chatting with a couple of friends, and we were talking in terms of what we would do, what kind of a business we could start off, and everything like that. To make a long story short, the more I kept thinking about it, I realized that I didn't think that I would be able to handle it. When I say handle it, is one thing to fight for a country, it's another thing to live there. With our own background, we are used to the finest things. We're a little used to nice home, nice car, nice everything. Israel being what it was, I didn't think that I would be able to handle the thing. So when I came back to stay.
Mm.
And
how long? What was the length of time?
The length of time, I guess I was there for about 10 months' time.
Mm-hmm.
I.
This is 1947.
This is 1949 now.
49.
No, it was 48, 49.
48.
So then, when I came back.
So the war had, for the most part, had ended.
Oh, yeah, the war was over. You see, the war, to bring it up to you now, Yetta, the war lasted technically a matter of weeks, and then the United Nations set up a ceasefire. Then, of course, we had this sporadic breakdown over here. And then, of course, if you remember, where they swept through the Sinai and took Nasser's, you know, battalion and
right.
all that. And then finally they set up a complete ceasefire. So it was a sporadic thing on and off that lasted just about those 8 or 10 months.
Mm-hmm.
So then when I came back, and it was a question of getting involved now in the community, when I think back, and I think you brought this out originally, in terms what did my Army experience mean to me from the Army? And I said, I didn't mean it. My going to Israel, being in the Army there, and my experience there, certainly changed my life in many, many, many ways. Well, just to give you on a 1-2-3 basis, when I came back, I remember again seeing Mr. Coder, and...
his name was Ben,
Ben Coder. Ben Coder, that's exactly right. So, Mr. Coder, and I came back, tried to get organized there, and he said that, Norman, he said he wanted me to be chairman of the Young Adult Division. They had started the year before.
I remember.
You remember.
I do.
Well, and I'll never forget this, because I said, well, look, I have no experience in fundraising or anything like that. I said, I have no experience. I said, well, what happened last year? He said, well, they was their first year, and they raised a little over $2,000. They had a special gift dinner for $15 for a special gift dinner, and they raised a little over $2,000. Well, I was thinking, and we were chit-chatting back and forth about what I would do or something. I said, you want to know something? If you want me to be chairman, I said, fine. I said, but if you want me to be chairman, let's take a goal of $10,000. So he started to laugh and said, Norman, it's nice to have big goals, but let's take a goal that you really think that you can do. I said, no. I said, I've already thought about the thing. And I said, there's no question on my mind. We can raise $10,000. Now, you speak in terms of a whole life. And in a whole life, what has to take place? You have to have goals. Without a goal, you go no place. But a goal all by itself, it's just a dream, it doesn't mean a damn thing. So first you have to have a goal, then you have to have a plan, and then it's strictly a question of executing your plan. So we took a goal of $10,000, and frankly my plan was this. As far as I was concerned, in those days, and you probably remember, Yetta, in those days the young adults in their 20s, I guess on an average, the average income could have been somewhere around $50 a week, which was about average, I guess. My thinking was anybody that was making $50 a week could certainly afford a dollar a week for a pledge. So that what we would have is a special gifts dinner. The special gifts dinner would be a $50 dinner, and you could do it on the basis of a dollar a week. Now, in my own mind, I was making a lot of money then. In those days, I was making $75 a week. And I was living at home, single, and I'd already decided I could certainly afford $10 a week to do. So that's $500. Well, to make a long story short, we had that special gifts dinner. It was a big, big success. I think we had something like 85 people who came there. And to make a long story short, that year, we raised a little over $11,000, and we were written up as the number one in communities of our size around the country. Now, that led to a lot of things. Because of the fact that I'd been in Israel, and with this, so naturally, they put me on the board of the Federation. and I was on several other boards. So you start to get involved, and there's no question that because of the experience and the meaning that it had for me, it set the tone for my whole life.
Mm.
I forgot the most important thing about that special gift center. At that special gift center, I met Helen.
Mm.
Now, Helen...
Helen who?
Helen Thomas's, my wife.
Okay.
All right, she was a dental hygienist working for the school system. She was making, I believe, $40 a week. I didn't know her. Interesting thing, she went to school with my brother, and I went to Delaware with Ralph, her brother. I knew there was a Helen, but I never met her, something like that. To make a long story short, she came to that special gift center, which was in October. I met her. When I met her, had a date with her. To make a very long story short, that was in October. In January, we were engaged, and on April the 1st, we were married. So, because of that special gift center, that's how I was
able. You won more than...
I won everything that I could possibly want that right.
So, that's a wonderful story. And you also have three children.
Oh, when you speak, you know, Yetam, when I look back, you know, when I was thinking of coming over here, when I look back at my life, I realize I am absolutely the most fortunate person in the whole world. In all ways, I have a wife that I just so thoroughly love, is so dear to me. I have the three most wonderful children anybody could possibly have, each in their own way. I have three grandchildren, right now 11, 14, and 17. If you would try to mold them, you couldn't ask for three greater or more wonderful children. And very frankly, when I think in terms of what a person does in their lifetime, when I look back, is I can be happy with what I've done, and I feel that I've added just a little bit. Now, to be able to feel that you've actually meant something in this world, and you're in that kind of a position with that kind of a family, what more can anybody want?
Not too much. Tell me about some of your, being chairman of this special gift for young people motivated you to get into many other aspects.
Well, what took place now? That started, and then as I said, I was on the board of the Federation, became an officer there, and then you get involved, and then a couple of years later, they asked me to be chairman of Israel Bonds for the state of Delaware. And I guess I was chairman for about 5 or 6 years at different times with that. And then it was a question, I became president of the JCC in 67. And then, in fact, when I mention that brings out, of course, then later on, I was president of Beth Shalom. So you get involved in all of these activities. Well, getting involved, when I mentioned the 67 war, that got me involved in its own way in what I consider one of the most important things I've ever done. And that is this. In the 67 war, and Yetta, you remember it so well, that Monday started in every Jewish community all over the world, had great big meetings and raised all kinds of money. We did the same thing, and I'm sure you and Sonny were there at Adas Kodesh. We had the biggest meeting that Wilmington has ever seen, and we raised all kinds of money. And every community did the same thing. Now, quite a few years later, I was chatting with a friend of mine, happened to be from Baltimore, and I don't know how we brought this subject up, and said, well, you know, in Baltimore, what they did that Monday before they had the first meeting, they wrote out a check for $1 million from their endowment fund and sent it to Israel. And, of course, naturally, they had their big meetings also. And when I heard about that, it started to dwell on me, and I started to realize what endowment really means and how important endowment is for the Jewish community. Endowment is to take care of, God forbid, emergencies, new programming, health, guidance, all of those things. So I start looking around. I knew we didn't have an endowment program, but I wanted to see what people had been doing in terms of that. At the time, I was president of Beth Shalom. Start checking, and I realized, and then I looked at the JCC and Federation, and I realized that all the big machers that I knew over the years, people who have been head of these organizations, contributed all kinds of money, worked awfully hard. When that time came, we didn't have a half a dozen people who had left even one nickel to the Jewish community or to their own organizations. And I couldn't understand it. I couldn't understand it for this reason. My own background, I remember Dad telling me the first time when he told me about his will, he said that in his will, they had set up so that all the organizations that were of interest to him, Beth Shalom, JCC, all of those, he had left X amount of dollars for each one of them. I assumed that that's what everybody did, and I find out nobody did. At first I was often angry, and then it suddenly occurred to me, it's a question of education.
Mm.
Now all of these people did what was normal, you left it all to the children. But I realized how important endowment is. And as far as I was concerned, this was the most important thing to do. So then I started to talk to some people, spoke to the president of the Federation, spoke to the executive director of the Federation. Everybody said, yes, endowment's a nice thing, this, that, and the other, but nothing was getting done. And this went on for a couple of years, and finally something had to be done. So what I did literally was call a meeting, and I invited the president of every single Jewish organization in the state of Delaware. That meant the president of each of the synagogues, the men's club, the Hadassah, B'nai B'rit, everyone. I had 41 people got together, and what I did is spoke to them about endowment, and I spoke to them about letter of intent. And I explained to them what a letter of intent was, and in terms of it wasn't legally binding, you know, and that it merely said that when that time comes, you can leave it in your will, you would leave X amount of dollars. How important it was, and put it on that basis. To make a long story short, 39 out of those 41 people signed a letter of intent. Now I went over to the Federation, here's 39 people who would like to leave money, we have to have an organization. Well, on the basis of that, then what they did is quickly put together, the attorneys got together, and it took quite some time before they set up all the legal paraphernalia for the thing. And I remember almost like yesterday, when we had our first meeting, regular meeting of an overall committee, and I remember sitting there chairing the committee, and I said, you know, because we had nothing, and I said, you know, I can envision when we'll have $10 million in our endowment. Everybody started to laugh. There goes, you know, Sonny again, you know, big ideas. Well, to make a long story short, today we have a little over $13 million in cash in that thing. And I have no idea as to how much money is sitting there in wills and things of that kind. So as far as I'm concerned, this is what I consider to be a wonderful and a very important thing. And what we're now doing, the endowment committee, we now have an executive director, and it's moving along. And frankly, my goal is that just like we have a goal that everybody should contribute to the Federation, in the same way, everybody should leave something on an endowment basis.
Tell me about the Melton School how you got involved in it.
Well, this is interesting. I thought they story on. With Melton School, this is about a year and a half ago.
Melton, M-E-L-T-O-N.
Melton, I guess about a year and a half ago, I happened to read an article about the Melton School for Adult Jewish Education, and it was sort of interesting. And I started checking around, found out their headquarters was in Chicago. I called up and I spoke with the executive director, and we had a good conversation. I told her to send me some material, and she sent me a lot of material. And the more I read and looked into it, and read a lot of articles there by people who had gone there, And at that time, I think they were in about 65 communities all over the world, and they'd been in existence for 15 years. I realized that we had to have a Melton School for Adult Jewish Education in Delaware. For what it would mean for individuals, for what it would mean for the entire community. Again, it's a question, you've got a goal, what's your plan, how are you going to do it? And in every other community, and I spoke to them at Melton, usually it would be a synagogue or a JCC or something like that, or a federation. One would have to do the thing. And I felt that as far as our community, the right thing to do was on a broad basis, and I did it this way. I called a meeting, had all the rabbis come, had Jude, the executive director of the Federation, and Jeff, the executive director of the JC. Jeff Metz.
And who was the other person?
What do you call Judy? Is he a go, what do you call executive
director? Judy Wortman. Judy Wortman.
Is the executive director of the Federation. Now, they all were familiar with Melton. They knew about the thing. So I certainly didn't have to sell them on the idea. And then I spoke to them on this basis, that what I would like to have, certainly from the rabbis, is their complete cooperation in four ways. Number one, they would join a board of trustees, meet once a year, give us a little help and guidance, direction. Number two, to promote it within their own synagogue. Number three, to recommend some of their people who would come as students. And number four, the way the Melton School works, it's a franchise, and in every one of them, the deficit is roughly between $20,000 and $25,000 a year. So the fourth thing I want them to do is to make a commitment of giving $1,000 a year on a forever basis to the Melton. And they all agreed to that completely. Mm-hmm. Now, it was a question of where would it be? Well, the natural thing in terms of location would be the JCC. I spoke to Jeff, and Jeff said, you know, Sonny, it's a great thing, but we certainly don't have the money. I said, let's not worry about it. I'm sure we can raise it. And finally, I got to the point, he said, but we don't have it in our budget. I said, I'll guarantee that we will have it. And on the basis of the guarantee, that's what we did. Well, to make a long story short, there was a question now of contacting some individuals and talking to them on this basis. First of all, I would go up to somebody and say, on a 1-10 basis, how would you place adult Jewish education? And I have a couple of people who would say, well, maybe about a 2 or a 3. And I would just drop it, well, what do you want to talk about? I said, there's nothing to talk about. If somebody would tell me adult Jewish education was a 7, 8, or a 9, then I would talk to them that I would like them to be a sponsor on the basis of $1,000 a year on a forever basis, because I certainly didn't want to be in a position that every year you've got to go out to try to raise the money. Well, we have a group that put together this kind of money. I think we still have about 3 more openings on that level right now. And we had the Melton School. And that's how it all came about. Now, this brings up an interesting thing. It's just the other day, Jeff called me up, and maybe this can wrap up the whole thing that we're talking about, as far as myself. He called me up to tell me, he said, Sonny, the board would, they're planning on giving you an award for having established the Melton School. And I said, that's ridiculous. He said, well, you're having their, the meeting.
The annual meeting,
going to be on June the 30th. Please come so that at least you can accept it. If not, to make a long story short, I told him honestly, I said, I'm embarrassed to get an award for something over which I had no choice. And this brings out this business of not having any choice. And I meant it for this reason. When I told you about going to Israel, I knew that if I didn't go, I wouldn't be able to live with myself. When I told to you with Melton, this is something that just had to be, when I spoke about annuity, what it called the in terms of endowment, the same thing happened about this feeling embarrassed years ago. I guess about 10 years ago, the same thing happened for the Federation call. They wanted to give me an award for being the primarily responsible for the whole endowment program. And again, I told them, I said, I would really be embarrassed about something like that. To be honored for something over which you have no choice. And I keep bringing this thing up because this is really the essence. When, as far as I'm concerned, anybody in terms of endowment, when I talk to somebody and speak about endowment, I usually put it on this way. If the future of the Jewish people is meaningful to you, then you have no choice. You have to do something like this. And that's really the essence.
Well, everyone doesn't do it. Obviously, you showed leadership. So, and especially as you get older, many people drop out. What did you do when you came home from Israel to make a living?
Oh, to make a living.
We haven't talked about that.
No, we'll do that real fast. Dad had sort of premonitions. To make a long story short, he bought a small wholesale tobacco and candy business. And for me to have, he wanted to make sure that things would go along. And I can do this rather quickly. I went into the business. It was up in Marcus Hook. I never really enjoyed it. I stayed in it for about 5 years or so. And then, in fact, Buddy joined with
me. Your brother.
My brother Buddy joined with me about 2 years afterwards. I'd have gotten out sooner. He got out of college, and we were partners there in running the business. Neither one of us really enjoyed it that much. And to make a long story short, we sold the business. And for about 6 months, I looked into 100 different things. And finally, I saw an ad in the Wall Street Journal about Snelling and Snelling, the executive search firm. And to make a long story short, it was a franchise. And I bought the franchise and set that up. And that I basically really enjoyed. Because in essence...
And what was it?
What it was, in an executive search, what you're doing, people who are looking for a better position come to you and you help them and guide them in getting a better job. So what our role was to screen and qualify the people who came to us for the positions that we had, and when we placed them, we would get a referral fee. So if somebody comes in to me and they're an accountant and they're looking for a better position than they have right now, and if we have an opening with the DuPont company and they seem to fit the thing, we set up an appointment, they go over to the DuPont company. If the DuPont company hires them, the DuPont company pays us a referral fee. So in essence, what I was doing was helping people, guiding them, and this gave me real satisfaction. And I did that for quite a few years.
Where did you get the experience? How did you...
Oh, well, this was a franchise.
So they trained
right.
You.
Right. In other words, the franchisor was right in Philadelphia. He had a big business in Philadelphia, and he had started the franchise just about 2 years before. I went up there and spoke with Lou Snelling, who's certainly no longer here now, and he had 11 franchises and had a training program. He was able to give me the whole thing there. I started there in Wilmington, and to make a long story short, he grew as a franchisor very, very much. In a matter of some years, he had a few hundred franchises. Right. I guess I was doing the same thing, because we were probably the leading office in the whole country. I wound up, I had four offices in Wilmington and in Newark, and I just thoroughly enjoyed what I was doing. We had 25 counselors in all those offices. And then, one day, this is quite a few years later, it suddenly dawned on me that with all these offices all over the country, we were literally interviewing thousands of people who were looking for a better position, and I just knew that many of those people could also be interested in a business of their own. So what I did is, while I was still running Snelling and Snelling, I started to evolve a new business called Franchise Brokers Network. What I had done is contacted some franchisors and told them that I would be able to screen and qualify for them people who were interested in going to their own business. Well, I was able to get more people because I contacted all the Snelling offices and said, I know that with all the people you see, many of them could be interested in their own business. If you have somebody, refer them to me, and naturally, any fees that we earn, we would split them. Well, I was getting more referrals than I knew what to do with. So as long as my referrals were coming from Philadelphia, Baltimore, or Washington, I could bring them into my office, and we were able to do something. But I was getting referrals from Atlanta, from Dallas, from San Francisco, and frankly, I couldn't handle it. I was spending all this time, certainly couldn't do anything on the phone. So that's when I decided to set up a network of offices and built the thing up so that we wound up with about 100 referral offices. Many of them were executive search firms. We had business brokers, accountants, attorneys, who joined with me for the inventory that I had of franchisors. And we represented now about 100 franchisors, manufacturing, sales, service, retail, food, automotive, motel, that would require an investment of anywhere from $10,000 to several million dollars. And when we would refer one of those people to a company, if they bought a franchise, franchisor could pay us a referral fee. And that's what we build up.
Well, and so are you still involved in that?
Oh, yes. I'm still involved. In other words, right now, I'm still doing exactly the same thing. The nice thing about it at this point, my business is essentially a telephone business, contacting companies and contacting the people that we have from around the country and referring people, and that's what I do. And the nice thing about it is my time is my own. And it gives me the time so that I can devote as much time, whether it be for Melton or endowment or whatever it might be.
So it sounds to me like you're never going to retire.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when people say, honey, you're 81 years old, when are you going to retire? And I said, God willing, I have no idea when that time will come.
When you get old.
No, it has nothing to do with getting old. It's simply a question. In fact, in my business, when people are referred in, most people don't know what they want to do anyway. So usually I'll sit down, chit-chat with them for a little while, and then I'll suddenly say, Yevon, I know exactly the right kind of business for you to get into. And I always get a real funny look or a smile, and then I tell them, you want to get into a business so that when you get up in the morning, you can't wait to get to the office. And then, of course, they understand exactly what I mean. And then sometimes I'll tell them, I'm the most fortunate person in the whole world. I thoroughly enjoy what I'm doing, and that's what you want to get involved with. Yeah. So I have that. Why should I retire? Yeah. I'm in a position, my time is my own. I thoroughly enjoy the business that I'm in. I enjoy the activities that I'm involved with, and God willing, to 120.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you found the secret of life.
There's a lot to that.
So you're indeed fortunate.